The appreciation of objects and subjects is the same for an enlightened as for an unenlightened person. The former has one greatness. He remains in the subjective mood, not lost in things. Believe omniscient, omnipotent, pervading.
So many people seem to be interested in meditation. But that interest cannot be very deep, because so very few are transformed through that interest. If interest is really deep, it becomes a fire by itself. It transforms you. Just through intense interest, you start becoming different. A new center of being arises. So many people seem to be interested, with nothing new arising in it. Not a new center is born. Not a new crystallization is achieved. They remain the same. That means they are deceiving themselves. The deception is very subtle. But the reception is bound to be there. You go on taking the medicine and the treatment, and the illness remains the same. Rather on the contrary, it goes on increasing. Your medicine, your treatment are bound to be false. Maybe deep down you don't want to be transformed. That fear is very real. The fear of transformation. So on the surface you go on thinking that you are deeply interested, and deep down you go on deceiving. The fear of transformation is just like the fear of death. It is a death, because the old will have to go and the new will come into being. You will no more be there. Something totally unknown to you will evolve out of you. Unless you are ready to die, your interest in meditation is false, because only those who are ready to die will be reborn. The new cannot become a continuity with the old. The old must discontinue. The old must go. Only then the new can come into being. The new is not an outgrowth of the old. The new is not continuous with it. The new is totally new. It comes only when the old dies. There is a gap between the old and the new, and that gap gives you fear. You are afraid. You want to be transformed, but simultaneously you want to remain the old. This is the deception. You want to grow, but you want to remain you. Then growth is impossible. Then you can only deceive. And then you can go on thinking and dreaming that something is happening, but nothing will happen. Because the basic point has been missed. So many people all the world over, so much interested in meditation, moksha, nirvana, and nothing is happening. So much noise about it, and nothing real happening. what's the matter. Sometimes the mind is so cunning that because you don't want to be transformed, the mind will create a superficial interest so that you can say to yourself, you are interested, you are doing whatsoever can be done, and you remain the same. And if nothing happens, you think the technique you are using is wrong, the guru you are following is wrong, the scripture, the principle, the method is wrong. But you never think that even with a wrong method, transformation is possible if the real interest is there. I say even with a wrong method, you will be transformed if you are really interested in transformation. Even following a wrong guru, you will become different. If your soul and your heart is in your effort, no one can mislead you except yourself. And nothing is a barrier to your progress except your own deceptions. When I say even a wrong master, wrong method, wrong principle can lead you to the real, I mean that the real transformation happens when you are intensely involved in it, not through any method. Method is just a device. Method is just a help. Method is secondary. Your being involved in it is foundational, fundamental. But we go on doing something, not even doing, go on talking about doing. And words create illusions. Because you think so much about it, you read so much about it, you listen so much about it, you start feeling that you are doing something. So-called religious persons have developed many devices of deception. I have heard one motorist was passing. Just by the side of the road, he saw the school building on fire, and the teacher of that small school, of that small village, was Mulla Nasruddin. He was sitting under a tree. This motorist called over that, what are you doing there? The school building is on fire. Mulla Nasruddin said, I know about it. The motorist was so much excited, he said, then why you are not doing something? Nasruddin said, ever since it started, I have been praying for the rains. I am doing something. Prayer is a trick to avoid meditation. And the so-called religious mind has developed many types of prayers. Prayer can also become a meditation when it is not only a prayer, but a deep effort of a deep involvement. Prayer also can become meditation, but ordinarily prayer is just an escape. To avoid meditation, people go on praying. To avoid doing anything, they pray. Prayer means God must do something, someone else must do. Prayer means we are passive, something must be done to us. Meditation is not prayer in that sense. Meditation is something you do to yourself. And when you are transformed, the whole universe behaves differently with you. Because the universe is nothing but a response to you, whatsoever you are. If you are silent, the whole universe responds to your silence in thousands and thousands of ways. It reflects you. Your silence is multiplied infinitely. If you are blissful, the whole universe reflects your bliss. If you are in misery, the same happens. The mathematics remains the same, the law remains the same. The universe goes on multiplying your misery. Prayers won't do. Only meditation can help. Because meditation is something authentically to be done. It is a doing on your part. So, the first thing I would like to say to you is be constantly alert that you are not deceiving. You may be doing something and still deceiving. I have heard that Mulla Nasruddin once came running into a post office, grasped the postmaster by the lapels, shook him and said, "I have gone crazy, my wife has disappeared." The postmaster felt sorry and he said, "Really? Has she disappeared? Unfortunate. But this is a postal department. You ought to go to the police department to report." Mulla Nasruddin nodded his head negatively. He said, "I'm not going to be caught again. In the past also my wife did disappear. And I reported to the policeman, to the police department, and they found her. So I'm not going to be caught again. If you can take the report, take it, otherwise I'm going." He wants to report and to feel good that I have done whatsoever can be done. But he doesn't want to report to the police department. He is afraid. You go on doing things just to feel good that you are doing. But really, you are not ready to be transformed. So all that you do just passes as useless activity. And not only useless, but harmful also, because it is a wastage of time, energy, opportunities. These techniques of Shiva are only for those who are ready to do. You can ponder over them philosophically. That means nothing. Actually, if you are ready to do, then something will start happening to you. They are alive methods, not dead doctrines. Your intellect is not needed. Your totality of being is required. And any method will do. If you are ready to give it a chance, any method will do, and you will become a new man. Methods are devices. I will repeat again. If you are ready, then any method can do. They are just tricks to help you take jump. Just like jumping boards. From any jumping board you can go to the ocean. Those jumping boards are insignificant. Of what color they are, of what wood they are made, is irrelevant. They are simply jumping boards. You can take a jump from them. All these methods are jumping boards. And whatsoever method catches your fancy, try it. Don't go on thinking about it. And when someone starts doing something, then difficulties arise. If you don't do anything, there will be no difficulties. Thinking is very easy going because you are not really traveling. When you start doing something, difficulties will arise. And if you see that difficulties have arisen, you can feel that you are on the right track. Something is happening to you. Then old barriers will break, old habits will go. There will be change, there will be disturbance and chaos. And every creativity comes out of chaos. You will be created new only if all that you are becomes chaotic. So these methods will destroy you first. And then only a new being will be created. So if difficulties are there, feel fortunate. That shows growth. No growth is smooth, and spiritual growth cannot be smooth. It is not its nature, because spiritual growth means going upward. Spiritual growth means reaching into the unknown. Reaching into the uncharted. Difficulties will be there. But remember that each difficulty, if passed, crystallizes you. You become more solid. You become more real. For the first time, you will feel something centering within you. Something becoming solid. As you are just a liquid phenomena, changing every moment. Nothing is stable. Really, you cannot claim any I. You don't have many I's, just in a flow, river-like flow. You are a crowd, not an individual yet, but meditation can make you an individual. This word individual is beautiful, it means indivisible. Right now as you are divided. Only many fragments, anyhow clinging together. Without any central being there, without any master in the house, only servants. And any servant for a moment can become the master. Every moment you are different because you are not. And unless you are, the divine cannot happen to you. To whom it can happen? You are not there. People come to me and they say, we would like to see God. I ask them, who will see? You are not there. The God is always there, but you are not there. Who will see? This is just a passing thought that I want to see God. Next moment they are not interested. Next moment they have forgotten all about it. A persistent, intense effort and longing is needed. than any method will do. Now, we should enter the methods. The first method, the appreciation of objects and subjects is the same for an enlightened as for an unenlightened person. The farmer has one greatness. He remains in the subjective mood, not lost in things. This is a very beautiful method. And you can start it as you are. No other prerequisite is needed. This method is simple. The method is, you are surrounded by persons, things, phenomena. Every moment something is around you. Things are there, events are there, persons are there. But because you are not alert, you are not there. Everything is there. You are fast asleep. Things move around you. Persons move around you, events move around you, but you are not there, or you are asleep. So whatsoever happens in your surroundings becomes master, becomes a force upon you. You are dragged by it. You are not only impressed, conditioned, you are dragged by it. Anything can catch you and you will follow it. Somebody passes. You look, the face is beautiful and you are carried away. The dress is beautiful, the color, the material is beautiful. You are carried away. The car passes. You are carried away. Whatsoever happens around you catches you. You are not powerful. Everything is more powerful than you. Anything changes you, your mood, your being, your mind, just depends on other things. Objects influence you. This sutra says that the enlightened person and the unenlightened persons live in the same world. A Buddha and you both live and move in the same world. The world remains the same. The difference is not in the world, the difference happens in the Buddha. He moves in a different way. He moves in the same objects, but he moves in a different way. He is his own master. His subjectivity remains aloof and untouched. That's the secret. A thing cannot impress. Anything from the outside cannot condition him. He remains detached. He remains himself. Nothing can overpower him. If he wants to go somewhere, he will go. But he will remain the master. If he wants to pursue a shadow, he will pursue. But it is his own decision. This distinction must be understood. By detachment, I don't mean a person who has renounced the world, because then there is no sense and no meaning of detachment. A detached person is a person who is living in the same world as you are living. The difference is not in the world. A person who renounces the world is changing the situation, not himself. And you will insist in changing the situation if you cannot change yourself? Well, that is the indication of a weak personality. A strong person, alert and aware, will try to change himself, not the situation in which he is. Because really the situation cannot be changed, first thing. And even if you can change the situation, there will be other situations. Every moment situations go on changing. And every moment the problem will be there. This is the difference between the religious and the non-religious attitude. The non-religious attitude always tries to change the situation, the surrounding. They don't believe in you. They believe in situations. They say if situation is okay, you will be okay. You are dependent to the situation. If the situation is not okay, you will not be okay. So you are not an independent entity. For communists, Marxists, socialists, and all those who believe in the change of this situation, you are not important. Really, you don't exist. Only the situation exists, and you are just a mirror who reflects the situation. The religious attitude says, as you are, you may be a mirror, but this is not your destiny. You can become something more who is not dependent. These are the three steps of growth. First, the situation is the master. You are just dragged by it. You only believe that you are, but you are not. The second stage, you are. The situation cannot drag you. The situation cannot influence you. You have become a will. You are integrated and crystallized. And the third stage, when you start influencing the situation, just by your being there, the situation changes. The first stage is of the unenlightened. The second stage is of the person who is constantly aware, but yet unenlightened. Because he has to be alert. He has to do something to be alert. The alertness has not become natural yet. He has to fight. If he loses consciousness, alertness for a single moment, he will be in the influence of the things. So he has to stand on his toes continuously. The seeker, the sadhak, one who is practicing something. And third is the siddha, the enlightened. He is not trying to be alert, he is simply alert. There is no effort to it. Alertness is just like breathing. It goes on. He is not to maintain it. When alertness becomes such a phenomenon like breathing, natural, sahaj, spontaneous, then this type of person, this type of a centered being automatically influences situations. Situations change around him. Not that he wishes them to change, but he is powerful. Power is the thing to be remembered. You are powerless. So anything can overpower you. And power comes through alertness, awareness. The more alert, the more powerful. The less alert, the less powerful. Look, while you are asleep, even a dream becomes powerful because you are fast asleep. You have lost all consciousness. Even a dream is powerful. You are so weak that you cannot even doubt. Even in an absurd dream, you cannot be skeptical. You will have to believe it. And while it lasts, it looks real. You may say just absurd things in a dream, but while dreaming, you cannot doubt. You cannot say this is not real. You cannot say this is a dream. You cannot say this is impossible. You simply cannot say because you are so fast asleep. The consciousness is not there. Even a dream affects you. While awake, you will laugh and you will say it was absurd, impossible, this cannot happen, this dream was just illusory. But you have not noticed that while it was there, you were influenced by it. You were totally taken over by it. Why? A dream was so powerful. The dream was not powerful, you were powerless. Remember this, when you are powerless, even a dream becomes powerful. While you are awake, a dream cannot influence you. But the reality, the so-called reality around us influences. An awakened person, enlightened person has become so alert that your reality also cannot influence him. A woman passes, a beautiful woman passes. Suddenly, you are carried away. The desire has arisen, the desire to purchase. If you are alert, the woman will pass, but the desire will not arise. You have not been influenced. You have not been taken over. When this happens for the first time, things move around you and you are not influenced. You feel a subtle joy of being. For the first time, really, you feel you are. Nothing can drag you out of you. If you want to follow, that is another thing. But that's your decision. But don't deceive. You can deceive. You can say, yes, the woman is not powerful. But I want to follow her. I want to purchase her. You can deceive. Many people go on deceiving. But you are deceiving nobody. You are deceiving yourself. And it is futile. Just close and look. You will know the desire is there. The desire comes first. And then you start rationalizing it. For an enlightened person, things are there. He is there, but there is no bridge between him and the things. The bridge has broken. He moves alone. He lives alone. He follows himself. Nothing else can possess him. Because of this feeling, we have called this attainment moksha, total freedom, mukti. He is totally free. All over the world, man hungers after freedom. You cannot find a man who is not hankering after freedom in his own way. In so many parts, man tries to find a state of being when he can be free. And anything that gives him a feeling of bondage, he resents. He hates it. Anything that hinders, that makes him imprisoned, he fights, he struggles against it. Hence, so many political fights, so many wars, revolutions. Hence, so many continuous family fights, wife and husband, father and son, fighting each other. The fight is basic. The fight is for freedom. The husband feels confined. The wife has imprisoned him. Now his freedom is cut. The wife feels the same. They both resent. They both fight. They both try to destroy the bondage. The father fighting the son, because every growth in the son means more freedom. Father son, and father feels he is losing something, the power, the authority. In family, in nations, in civilizations, only one thing man is hankering after, it is freedom. But nothing is achieved through political fights, revolutions, wars. Nothing is achieved. Because even if you get the freedom, it is superficial. Deep down you remain in bondage. So every freedom proves a disillusionment. Man longs so much for wealth. It is not a longing for wealth as far as I understand it. It is a longing for freedom, because wealth gives you a feeling of freedom. If you are poor, you are confined. Your means are limited. You cannot do this, you cannot do that. You don't have the money to do it. The more money you have, the more you feel you have freedom. You can do anything you like. But when you have all the money and all that you will wish, imagine, dream to do, you can do, suddenly you feel this freedom is superficial. Because inside your being knows it well that you are powerless and anything can drag you. You are impressed, influenced, purchased by things and persons. This sutra says that you have to come to a state of consciousness where nothing impresses you. You can remain detached. How to do it? The whole day, the opportunity is there to do it. That's why I said this method is good. You can do it. Any moment you become aware something is possessing you, take a deep breath, inhale a deep breath, and then exhale deeply, and then look at the thing again. While you are exhaling, look at the thing again, and look just as a witness, as a spectator. Even for a single moment, if you can achieve the witnessing state of mind, suddenly you will feel you are alone. Nothing can impress you, at least in that moment. Nothing can create desire in you. Take a deep inhalation and exhale whenever you feel that something is impressing you, influencing you, dragging you away from you. Something is becoming more important than yourself. And in that small gap, of exhalation, look at the thing. A beautiful face, a beautiful body, or a beautiful building, or anything. Exhale, and while exhaling, look at the thing. And if you feel it is difficult, if just by exhaling you cannot create the gap, then do one more. Exhale and stop inhalation for a single moment. So the exhalation has thrown all the air out. Stop, don't inhale, and then look at the thing. When the air is out or in, and you have stopped breathing, nothing can influence you. In that moment you are unbridged. The bridge is broken. The breathing is the bridge. Try it. It will be only for a single moment you will have the feeling of witnessing. But that will give you the taste. That will give you a feeling of what witnessing is. Then you can pursue it. The whole day, whenever something impresses you and a desire is to arise, exhale, stop in the interval and look at the thing. The thing will be there, you will be there, but there will be no bridge. Breathing is the bridge. Suddenly you will feel you are powerful, you are potential. And the more you feel powerful, the more you will become. And the more things drop, the more their power over you drops, the more crystallized you will feel. Individuality has begun. Now you have a center to refer. And any moment you can move to the center and the world disappears. Any moment you can take shelter into your own self center, and the world is powerless. This sutra says the appreciation of objects and subjects is the same for an enlightened as for an unenlightened person. The former has one greatness. He remains in the subjective mood, not lost in things. He remains in the subjective mood. He remains within himself. He remains centered in consciousness. This remaining in the subjective mood has to be practiced. And as many opportunities as you can get, try. And every moment there is opportunity. Every single moment there is opportunity. Something or other is impressing you, dragging you out, pulling you out, pushing you in some desire, some direction. I am reminded of an old story. A great king, Arthari, renounced the world. He renounced the world because he had lived in it totally. He had come to a realization that it is futile. It was not a doctrine to him. It was a lived reality. He has come to a conclusion through his own life. He was a man of strong desires. He had indulged in life as much as possible. Then suddenly he realized it is useless, futile. He left the world, he renounced, he went to a forest. He was meditating under a tree. The sun was rising, suddenly he became aware just on the street, the small street which passed nearby the tree, a very big diamond was there. As the sun was rising, it was reflected in the rays. Even Bhartari had not seen such a big diamond ever before. Suddenly, in a moment of unawareness, a desire arose to possess it. The body remained unmoved, but the mind has moved. The body was in the posture of Siddhasana. He was meditating. But the meditation was no more there. Only the dead body was there. The mind has moved. The mind has gone to the diamond. But before he could move, two men came running from different directions on their horses. And both the horsemen became aware simultaneously of the diamond lying on the street. They pulled their swords. And everyone, each one was claiming that he had seen the diamond first. There was no other way to decide, so they had to fight. They fought, they killed each other. Both were dead within moments. Two dead bodies were lying there around that diamond. Bhartari laughed, closed his eyes, went into meditation again. What happened? He again realized the futility. And what happened to these two men? The diamond became more meaningful than their own life. And this is what possession means. They could throw away their lives just for a stone. When desire is there, you are no more. The desire can lead you to suicide. Really, every desire is leading you to suicide. But when you are in the power of a desire, you are not in your senses. You are just mad. The desire had arisen in Bhartari's mind also to purchase. In a single fragment of moment, the desire had arisen. And he may have moved, but before he could move, these two persons came and they fought. And there were two dead bodies lying there. And the stone was there in its own place. Bhartari laughed, closed his eyes, went into his meditation again. For a single moment, his subjectivity was lost. The stone, the diamond, the object became more powerful. Again, the subjectivity was regained. With the diamond, the whole world disappeared. He closed his eyes. Since centuries, meditators have been closing their eyes. Why? They are only symbolic. The world has disappeared. There is nothing to look at. Not worth even to look at. You will have to remember continuously, whenever desire arises, you have moved out of your subjectivity. This is the world, this movement. Regain, move back, get centered again. And whenever you will be able, and you will be able, because the capacity is there with everyone. No one ever loses the inner potential. It is always there. You can move. If you can move out, you can move in. If I can go out of my house, why I cannot come within back? The same route has to be traveled. The same legs have to be used. I can go out, I can come in. Every moment you are moving out, whenever you move out, remember and suddenly come back. Be centered. If you feel it is difficult in the beginning, then take a deep breath, exhale, stop. In that stop moment, look at the thing which was attracting you. Really, nothing is attracting you, you were attracted. That diamond there, lying on that street in that lonely forest, was not attracting anybody. It was simply lying there, being itself. The diamond was not aware that Bhartari has been attracted. Someone has moved from his meditation, from his subjectivity, come to the world. Someone has come into the world. The diamond was not aware that two persons have lost their lives for it. So nothing is attracting you, you get attracted. Be alert and the bridge will be broken. And you will regain balance inside. Go on doing it more and more. The more you do, the better. A moment will come when you will not need to do it, because the inner power will give you such a strength that the attraction of things will be lost. It is your weakness which is attracted. Be more powerful and nothing will attract you, and only then for the first time you are master of your own being. That gives you real freedom. No political freedom, no economic freedom, no social freedom can be of much help. Not that they are not desirable, they are good in themselves, but they will not give you the thing which the innermost core of your being is longing for. The freedom from things, from objects. The freedom to be oneself without any possibility of being possessed by anything or anybody. Second technique is similar in a way, but from a different dimension. Believe omniscient, omnipotent, pervading. That too is based on inner power, inner strength. Very seed-like. Believe that you are omniscient, all-knowing. Believe that you are omnipotent, all-powerful. Believe that you are pervading, all-pervading. How can you believe? It is impossible. You know you are not all-knowing. You are ignorant. You know you are not all-potent. You are absolutely powerless, helpless. You know you are not all-pervading. You are confined in a small body. So how can you believe it? And if you believe knowing well that this is not the case, the belief will be useless. You cannot believe against yourself. You can force a belief, but it will be useless, meaningless. You know it is not so. A belief becomes useful only when you know that this is so. This has to be understood. A belief becomes powerful. If you know this is the case, true or untrue is not the point. If you know this is the case, a belief becomes truth. If you know this is not the case, then even a truth cannot become a belief. Why? Many things have to be understood. First, whatsoever you are is your belief. You believe that way. You have been brought up in that way. You have been conditioned in that way. So you believe. And your belief influences you. It becomes a vicious circle. For example, there are races where man is less powerful than woman, because those races believe that a woman is more powerful, more strong, is stronger than man. Their belief has become a fact. In those races, man is weaker, woman is stronger. The woman goes on doing all the work that ordinarily in other countries men will do. And men go on doing the work that in other countries women will do. Not only that, their bodies are weak. Their structure is weak. They have come to believe that this is so. The belief creates phenomena. Belief is creative. Why this happens? Because mind is more powerful than matter. So if mind believes really something, the matter has to follow. The matter cannot do against the mind. Matter is dead. Even impossibles happen. Jesus says, faith can move mountains. Faith can move. And if your faith cannot move, that only means that you don't have faith. Not that faith cannot move mountains. Your faith cannot move. Because you don't have faith. Now, much research is going on this phenomenon of belief. And science is coming to many unbelievable conclusions. Religion always believed. But science is coming to those same conclusions. It has to come. Because many phenomena for the first time are being searched. For example, you may have heard about placebo medicines. There are hundreds and hundreds pathies in the world, allopathy and Ayurvedic and Yunani and homeopathy and naturopathy, and hundreds. And they all claim that they can cure. And they cure. Their claims are not false. This is a rare thing, because their diagnosis is different, their treatment is different. There is one illness and there are 101 diagnoses and then 101 treatments, and every treatment helps. So the question is bound to be raised whether really treatment helps or the belief of the patient. This is impossible. So in many countries, in many ways, in many universities, in many hospitals, they are working on placebo medicines, just water or something non-medicinal is given, but the patient believes that a medicine has been given. Not only the patient, but the doctor also believes, because the doctor is not also aware. Because even if the doctor is aware, that will affect. Because more than the medicine, the doctor gives the belief to the patient. So when you pay more and you have a bigger doctor, you get well better and sooner. It is a question of belief. If the doctor just gives you a 4 anna medicine, just 4 annas, you know well that nothing is going to happen. How? Such a big patient with such a big disease, such a great phenomena, is going to be cured by 4 annas? Impossible. The belief cannot be created. Every doctor has to create around him a phenomena of belief, an aura of belief that helps. So if the doctor knows that this is just water he is giving, he will not give with belief, with faith. His face will show, his hand will show, his whole attitude and behavior will show that he is giving just water. And the unconscious of the patient will be affected. The doctor must believe. The more he believes, the better, because his belief is infectious. The patient looks at the doctor. If the doctor feels confident that, don't worry, this is a new treatment, a new medicine, this is going to help you 100%, there is no doubt about it. The whole personality of the doctor gives the impression of 100% hope already. Even before giving the medicine, the patient is being cured. Already the cure has started. And now they say that whatsoever you give, 30% patients will be cured almost immediately. Whatsoever you give, allopathy, naturopathy, homeopathy, or any pathy, or any homemade pathy, whatsoever you do, 30% patients will be cured immediately. Those 30% are believers. That is the ratio. If I look at you, then in you 30% are the potential ones who can immediately be transformed. Once they get the belief, immediately the belief will start working. 1/3 of all humanity can be immediately transformed, changed to new orders of being without any difficulty. Just the question is how to create the belief in them. Once the belief is there, then nothing can debar them. You may be one of those fortunate ones, the 30%. But a great misfortune has happened to humanity, And that is, those 30% are condemned. The society, the education, the civilization, all condemn them. They are thought to be stupid people. They are more potential people. They have a great power, but they are condemned. And impotent intellectual people are praised because they can play with language, words, reason. They are praised. And really, they are simply impotent. They cannot do anything in the real world of inner being. They can just go on with their mind. But they possess the universities. They possess the news media. They are the masters in a way. And they are artists in condemnation. They can condemn anything. And this 30% potential humanity, those who can believe and can get transformed, they are not so articulate. They cannot be. They cannot reason. They cannot argue. That's why they can believe. So they cannot argue their case. They have themselves become self-condemned. They think something is wrong. If you can believe, you start feeling that something is wrong with you. If you can doubt, you think something is great with you. But doubt is not a force. Through doubt, never anyone got to the innermost being, to the ultimate ecstasy. No one ever. If you can believe, then this sutra will be helpful for you. Believe, omniscient, omnipotent, pervading. You are that already. And just by believing it, all that is hiding you, that is covering you, will fall down immediately. But even for those 30% ones, it will be difficult. Because they are also conditioned to believe in something which is not the case. They are also conditioned to doubt. They are also trained to be skeptical. And they know their limitations of how they can believe. Or if they believe, people will think they are mad. So if you say that you believe that inside you is the all-pervading, the omnipotent, the divine, the all-powerful, then people will look at you and they will think you have gone crazy. How can you believe such things unless you are mad? But try something. Start from the very beginning. Have a little feeling of this phenomena, then belief will follow. Do one thing. If you want to use this technique, close your eyes and just feel that you have no body. As if the body has disappeared, melted away. Then you can feel your all-pervadingness. With the body it is difficult. That's why many traditions go on teaching that feel that you are not the body. Because with the body, limitation comes in. If you can feel you are not the body, and it is not difficult because you are not the body. This is just a conditioning that you are the body. This is just a thought that has been forced upon your mind. Your mind has been impregnated with the thought that you are the body. There are phenomena. In Ceylon, Buddhist monks walk on the fire. In India also. But the Ceylonese phenomena is very rare. They walk for hours. They are not burnt. So it happened once, just few years before. One Christian missionary went to see the fire walk. They do it on the night when Buddha became enlightened. The full moon night when Buddha became enlightened, they do it. Because on that day, they say, it was revealed to the world that body is nothing, matter is nothing, the inner being is all pervading, the fire cannot burn. But for this, those monks who walk on the fire for 1 year completely, they purify their bodies through pranayama, breathing processes, fasting, meditate, purify their minds, empty their minds. For 1 year continuously they prepare. They live in isolated cells, just feeling that they are not their bodies. For 1 year continuously, a group of 50, 60 monks goes on thinking they are not their bodies. A year is a long thing. Every moment thinking only one thing, they are not their bodies. Continuously hammering, the body is illusory. They come to believe. Then too, they are not forced to walk on the fire. They are brought to the fire, and then whosoever thinks that he will not be burned, he jumps into it. Few remain doubting, hesitating. They are not allowed. Because this is not a question of fire burning or not, this is a question of their doubt. If they hesitate a little, they are stopped. So 60 are prepared, sometimes 20, sometimes 30 people jump into it. They dance in the fire for hours together without any burning. One missionary came to see it just in 1950, and he was so much surprised. And then he thought, if belief in Buddha can do this miracle, then why not believe in Jesus? So he thought for a while, he hesitated a little, but then the idea was this, that if Buddha can help, then Jesus will also help. So he jumped. He got burned, badly burned, had to be hospitalized for 6 months. But he couldn't understand what was the phenomena. It is not a question of Jesus or Buddha. It is not a question of belief in someone, it is a question of belief. And that belief has to be hammered into the mind. Unless it reaches to the very core of your being, then it starts working, then it functions. So that Christian missionary went back to England to study about hypnosis, mesmerism and allied phenomena, that what is happening in this fire walking. Then they invited two monks in the Oxford University to give a demonstration. The monks went. They walked on the fire. Many times the experiment was tried. Then those two monks saw that one professor was looking at them, and he was looking so deeply and he was so involved, his eyes, his face, they were ecstatic. So those 2 months went near the professor and told him that you can also come with us. Immediately he ran with them, jumped into the fire, and nothing happened. He was not burnt. That Christian missionary was also present. And he knew well that this professor was a professor of logic. A man who is professionally doubtful. His profession is based on doubt. So he asked that man, "What? You have done a miracle. I couldn't do it, and I am a believer." The professor said, "In that moment, I was a believer. This phenomenon was so real, so fantastically real, it gripped me. It was so clear that body is nothing and mind is everything. And I felt so ecstatically in tune with these 2 monks. Then when they invited me, there was not a single hesitation. It was so simple to walk on it, just as if there was no fire. But there was no hesitation, no doubt. That is the key. So first, to try this experiment, sit with closed eyes for a few days, just thinking that you are not your body. Not only thinking, but feeling that you are not your body. And if you sit with closed eyes, a distance is created. Your body goes on moving away and away. You go on moving inwards. A great distance is created. And you can feel you are not the body. If you feel you are not the body, then you can believe you are all-pervading, omnipotent, omniscient, all-knowing, all-powerful. This all-powerfulness or this all-knowingness is not concerned with so-called knowledge. It is a feeling, an explosion of feeling, that you know. This has to be understood, particularly in the West. Whenever you say that you know, they will ask, "What? What do you know?" Knowledge must be objective. You must know something. And if it's a question of knowing something, you cannot be all-pervading. No one can be. Because infinite facts are there to be known. No one can be all-knowing in that sense. That's why in the West they laugh when Jains claim that Mahavira was Sarvajna, all-knowing. They laugh, because if Mahavir was all-knowing, then he must have known all that science is discovering now, even that which science will discover in future. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And obviously, he says many things which are contradictory to science, which cannot be true, which are not factual. His knowledge, if it is all-pervading, must never be erroneous, but there are errors. Christians believe that Jesus was all-knowing, but the modern mind will laugh. Because he was not all-knowing. all-knowing in the sense of knowing all the facts and knowing all about the facts of the world. He didn't know that though the earth is circular. The earth is a globe. He didn't know it. He knew that the earth is a flat ground. He didn't know that the earth has been in existence for millions and millions of years. He believed that God created just 4,000 years before him. As far as facts, objective facts are concerned, he is not all-knowing. But this word all-knowing is totally different. When the Eastern sages say all-knowing, they don't mean knowing all about the facts. They mean all-conscious, all-aware, fully inside, fully conscious, enlightened. They are not concerned with knowing something, they are concerned only with the pure phenomena of knowing. Not knowledge, but the very quality of knowing. When we say Buddha knows, we don't mean that he knows what Einstein knows. He doesn't know that. He is a knower. He knows his own being. And that being is all-pervading. That feeling of isness is all-pervading. And in that knowing, nothing remains to be known. That's the point. Now, there is no curiosity to know anything. All questions have dropped. Not that all answers have been achieved. All questions have dropped. Now there is no question to be asked. All curiosity has gone. There is no problem to be solved. This inner quietness, this inner silence, filled with inner light, is infinite knowing. This is what is meant by omniscient. Subjective awakening. This you can do. And this will not happen if you go on adding more knowledge to your mind. You can go on adding for lives together. You will know something, but you will never know all. The all is infinite. It cannot be known in that way. Science will remain always incomplete. It can never be complete. That's impossible. Inconceivable that it can be complete. Really, the more science knows, the more it comes to know that more has to be known. This all-knowingness is an inner quality of awakening. Meditate and drop your thoughts. When you don't have any thought, you will feel what this omniscience is, what this all-knowledge is. When there is no thought, consciousness becomes pure, purified. In that purified consciousness, you don't have any problem. All questions have dropped. You know yourself, your being. And when you know your being, you have known all. Because your being is the center of everybody's being. Really, your being is everybody's being. Your center is the center of universe. In this sense, Upanishads have declared, Aham Brahmasmi, I am the Brahma, I am the Absolute. Once you know this little phenomena of your being, you have known the infinite. You are just like a drop of the ocean. Even if one drop is known, all the secrets of the ocean become revealed. Believe, omniscient, omnipotent, pervading. But this will come through faith. This you cannot argue with yourself. You cannot convince yourself with some argument. You will have to dig deep within you for such feelings, sources for such feelings. This word believe is very significant. It doesn't mean that you have a conviction, because conviction means a rational thing. You are convinced. You have argued it over. You have proofs for it. Belief means you don't have any doubts about it, not proofs. Conviction means you have proofs. You can prove, you can argue, you can say this is so. You can reason it out. Belief means you don't have any doubts. You cannot argue it. You cannot rationalize. You will be defeated if you argue. But you have an inner grounding. You feel it is so. It is a feeling, not a reasoning. Remember that such techniques can work only if you work with your feeling, not with your reasoning. So it has happened so many times that very ignorant people, uneducated, uncultured, reach heights of human consciousness. And those who are very much cultured, educated, reasonable, rational, they miss. Jesus is just a carpenter. Friedrich Nietzsche somewhere writes that in the whole New Testament there is only one person really worth, who is cultured, educated, philosophically knowledgeable, wise, and that man is Pilate, the Roman governor, who ordered Jesus to be crucified. And really, he was the most cultured man. The governor general, he was there. Viceroy, he was there. And he knew what philosophy is. And he asked in the last moment, when Jesus was going to be crucified, he asked, "What is truth?" It was a very philosophical question. And Jesus remained silent. Not that this person was not worth answering. He was the only person who could have understood deep philosophy. But Jesus remained silent because he could speak only to those who can feel. Thinking was not of any use. You can go on philosophizing. And he was asking a philosophical question. It was good if he had asked it in a university, in some academy. But asking Jesus a philosophical question was meaningless. He remained silent. It was futile to answer. No communication was possible. But Nietzsche, himself a man of reason, condemns Jesus. He says he was uneducated, uncultured, unphilosophical. He couldn't answer. That's why he remained silent. Pilate asked a beautiful question. If he had asked to Nietzsche, he would have talked about it for years together. What is truth? This is one question is enough to talk for years and discuss about it. The whole philosophy is just this business of what is truth. The one question, and all the philosophers are involved in it. So Nietzsche's criticism is really the criticism of reason, condemnation of reason. Reason has been condemning always the dimension of feeling, because feeling is so vague, so mysterious. It is there and you cannot say anything about it. Either you have got it or you don't have got it. Either it is there or it is not there. You cannot do anything about it and you cannot discuss it. You also have many beliefs, but those beliefs are just convictions. They are not beliefs, because you have doubts about them. You have crushed those doubts by your arguments, but they are there. You are sitting on top of them, but they are there. You go on fighting with them, but they are not dead. They cannot be. That's why your life, it may be of a Hindu or a Mohammedan or a Christian or a Jain, but it's only of convictions. Faith is not there. I will tell you one anecdote. Jesus told his disciples to move in a boat to the other bank of a lake where they were staying. And he said, I will be coming later. So they moved. When they were just in the middle of the lake, a great wind came and there was much turmoil. And they were afraid. And the boat was rocking. And they started crying and screaming. And they started crying, Jesus. And the bank where Jesus was very distant from there. Save us. So Jesus came. It is said, he came running on the water. And the first thing he said to his disciples was, men of little faith, why are you crying? Don't you believe? They were scared. Jesus said, if you believe, then come out of the boat and walk towards me. He was standing on the water. And they were seeing with their own eyes that he is standing on the water. But still, it is difficult to believe. Still, I say it is difficult to believe. Jesus was standing on the water, but they must have thought in their mind there must be some trick. Or it must maybe just an illusion. Or this may not be Jesus. This may be just the devil alluring them or something. So they started looking to each other. Who will walk? Then one disciple came out of the boat and he walked Really, he could walk. He couldn't believe his own eyes. He was walking on the water. And when he came just near Jesus, he said, "But how? How it is happening?" Immediately. The whole miracle disappeared. The how. And he was underwater. Jesus pulled him out and said, "Man of little faith, why you ask how? But reason asks why, how. Reason asks. Reason is questioning. Faith is dropping of all questions. If you can drop all questions and believe, then this technique can work miracles for you. Enough for today.